Turn in your Bibles once again tonight to the book of Habakkuk. When I started this book, I think I told you the last time that I didn't expect it to last very long. I thought probably about 3 weeks I'd be done, you know, about a chapter 1 week and a chapter the next week, and I'd go on to the end that way, and that would be all of it. But it didn't work out like I thought it might. There is a great deal in this little book. I don't know. It seems as if the Lord may be directing me toward a sermon from this book. I said quite a bit about the verse when I came to it in the study, but I see a great deal more in it, and I'll say tonight that 20th verse would make a good sermon. But let's look into our lesson. We're still looking at these five woes, and there are yet two more of them that we're going to look at tonight. The fourth, beginning there at the 15th verse. Then we have the fifth that really begins in verse 19, though the introduction to it starts in verse 18. What we're seeing mostly in this chapter is God's predicted judgment upon the Babylonians for their invasion of the land of Judah. And it is certainly evident as you go through the book that whatever a man sows, that he'll also reap. And we're seeing how that the law of divine retribution comes out time after time. We have seen it already earlier, and we're going to see it again, because what you do unto others, God will do unto you. And that will come out in this lesson here tonight again. Now, the description is primarily of the Babylonians. And it's certainly true of any person that would be guilty of the sins that are mentioned, whether they be Jew or Gentile. Beginning in verse 15 down through verse 17 is the fourth woe, and it's woe to the promoters of drunkenness, for they will suffer shame and disgrace. Now, look how the language reads in the 15th verse. There are two things that are wrong. Woe to him that giveth his neighbor drink, that putteth thy bottle to him, and makest him drunk also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. This is not merely just offering your neighbor a drink, but if you look at the way that it reads, it's forcing him to drink. Makest him drunk. Puttest the bottle to him. That's forcible drinking if you look at the way that it reads. Man is either being compelled by strong words or being compelled by, shall we say, the power of Babylon to do whatever the soldiers tell him to do. In either case, the Israelites are the ones that are having the bottle put to their mouth. And they're the ones that are becoming drunken and naked. And of course, the results is going to be that God will judge the Babylonians with the same judgment that they're meting out to Israel at this time. But really what we have in the 15th verse is God's condemnation of those that promote drunkenness. And the Bible is clear that drunkenness is a sin. Anybody that's half drunk is half drunk. He's very near being totally drunk. And he's certainly out of the will of God. But now, there are quite a few things here. It starts off and it doesn't even tell what the neighbor's drinking to begin with. It says that giveth his neighbor a drink. Well, now, if that's all it said, and it was a drink of cold water, there would be no evil. As a matter of fact, that would be something that would merit a reward from God. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 42, "And whosoever shall give to drink unto one of these little ones a cup of cold water, only in the name of a disciple, verily I say unto you, he shall in no wise lose his reward." So even a small trivial matter like giving your neighbor a drink of cold water on a hot day can merit a reward, but that's not the kind of drink that's in Habakkuk. This being generous and kind is also seen again in Matthew 25, in verse 35. There it is, the sheep and goat nations. And the Lord said to the sheep nations, I was athirst, and you gave me drink. And then he went on to say, inasmuch as you did it unto one of the least of these my brethren, you did it unto me. And so, you can see how that it could have been a blessing here rather than a curse. But what they're doing is not giving the neighbor a drink of cold water. They're giving him a drink of wine or some other alcoholic drink. And that is what God pronounces a woe upon, to the person that gives the bottle to the other man. You know, when I look at that verse, I wonder how bartenders are going to fare when they stand at the judgment seat of God. Because there seems to be an awful woe there pronounced upon the one that puts the bottle to him. And what about the fellow that voted for it to be that way? What's going to happen to him? There are going to be a lot of fellows not guiltless when they stand before God. Now, he did not just give him this bottle, did not just put it to his mouth, but he made him to drink. He gave him the bottle with the sole purpose of the design of his becoming intoxicated. And that is the abominable wickedness that God here condemns. And such a person is a rebel against the God of heaven, and he is a promoter of the devil and his cause in this world. And he's under the curse of God, the woe of God, as plainly seen there. Now, one of the problems with drunkenness is that it produces nakedness. I might hasten to add, both spiritual and physical. You say, well, I didn't know it produced physical. Well, I do. There was a church member in the state of Missouri just before I became pastor. I was glad it happened before I got there, incidentally, because I'm pretty sure I know what I'd had to do. But anyway, she went down to the VFW club on Saturday night with her husband, and they all got real drunk, and she pulled off all of her clothes in there that night. And the police came and arrested her and put her in jail. Now, she was under the influence, and she would not normally have done that, I'm certain, but that is what she did. You see, whenever that demon of alcohol overcomes a man, it'll lead him to do a lot of other things. Now, there's a place in the book of Proverbs where adultery and whoredom is connected with alcohol, the same as in the book of Hosea. But here, the sin of nakedness is connected with drunkenness. If you just want to know what a man might do when he gets drunk, he'll do what he wouldn't ordinarily do. What happened to Noah? Go back to Genesis chapter 9. Look there at verse 20 and 21. Noah began to be an husbandman, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank the wine and was drunken, and he was uncovered within his tent. In other words, he didn't have his clothes on. He was naked. That sin of nakedness is connected often with drinking. In the book of Lamentations, chapter 4, verse 21, you'll find a connection here between drunkenness. The latter part of it says, thou shalt be drunken and shalt make thyself naked. There's one thing that I've always noticed. People that patronize places where there's a lot of drinking going on usually don't have on many clothes. Have you ever noticed that? All you got to do, you don't have to go inside, just drive up and down the road outside. We got them right up the road here. I don't have to go very far to see it around here. And you'll find out they'll be scantily clad or not even that well sometime if you look at them close. So here is one of the problems with alcohol. The abuse of it makes people do what they would not ordinarily do, such as take off all of their clothes and expose their body to the sight of other people. And so here was a man that got drunk and pulled his clothes off. probably laying there in his drunken stupor without his clothes on. Must have been an awful sight to behold. Now, the language here, puttest, makest, those verbs are very strong in our language as well as the original. And they suggest a strong, insistent, and repeated action on the part of someone. The one that's putting the bottle to the man's mouth, that would be the person here. So the person's being forced to drink, more or less. Now look what's going to happen to these Babylonians that are forcing the Judeans to drink. Thou art filled with shame for our glory. Drink thou also, and let thy foreskin be uncovered. The cup of the Lord's right hand shall be turned unto thee, and shameful spewing shall be on thy glory. Now it seems to me when I read that, that these Babylonians are being pictured as under the judgment of God. And that description is as a drunkard that's lying naked, wallowing in his own vomit. God is saying that's what you're doing to the Judeans now, but one day I'll do that to you, and I'll treat you like you're treating them now. You know, one of the great sins of Babylon, if you go back and read in Daniel chapter 5 and many other places, is they were given to drunkenness. That was one of the sins of Babylon. It's still a common sin in the Babylonian world system of our time and continues to be. So that was what God pictured the judgment of Babylon going to be like. Now they were really taking glory in the fact that they were making the Judeans drunk and naked. And God said he was going to turn their so-called glory into their shame. They would be drunk and they would be naked before he finished with them. And I believe the idea here, really, if you look at the way that it reads, around people that drink, there's an old saying, you know, pass around the bottle and we'll all take a drink. And the fellow, you know, he'll open the bottle and he'll pass it around. But what? It finally comes back to him, you see. Well, that's the idea here. The Babylonians were passing around the bottle to the Judeans and other countries that they conquered. But the time would come when the right hand of God would bring it around to the mouth of the king of Babylon. And he'd have to take a drink too. And he would know shame and disgrace. And so the Lord is meting out rather strong judgment there. They had given other people the cup of drunkenness. And now God is going to make them suffer for that. It's actually stated in the Bible that they did make other people drunk. In Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 7. Babylon hath a golden cup in the Lord's hand that made all the earth drunken. The nations have drunken of her wine, therefore the nations are mad. And so that was something that they did. You know, it's remarkable that the Babylon here in the book of Habakkuk is exactly described in the same way that Babylon of the end time is. Do you know one of the charges that's brought against the Babylonian world system during the tribulation? It's seen in the book of Revelation chapter 17 and verse 2. It's the same charge we have over there in the book of Jeremiah. With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So Babylon in the days of Habakkuk has exactly the same characteristics of Babylon in the time of the tribulation. And really those systems are all one and the same. They're just described in different times and places. But in a sense, that very system that existed that conquered Judah in the days of Habakkuk is that same system that God will be against, and that Antichrist will rule over in the tribulation. That's why it's still called Babylon, both places. Even the Israelites had to drink of this cup from Babylon, as we learn from Isaiah 51:17. But the idea here in our text is that as Babylon has passed around the bottle, it's going to come back pretty soon to them, and they've got to take a drink. It'll be their turn, you see. That's one of the warnings that we have in the book of Jeremiah, and it tells how that the cup is going to come back to Babylon and how that Babylon's going to have to drink. Now remember that Jeremiah and Habakkuk are contemporary prophets. They lived at the same time. And they wrote about the same people in the same era and all of that. But in the 25th chapter of the book of Jeremiah, and if you look here, it's about Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. That's what the subject is. But look in the 15th verse. For thus saith the Lord God of Israel unto me, take the wine cup of this fury at my hand, and cause all the nations to whom I send thee to drink it. They'll drink and be mad, he goes on to say there. Then go on down to verse 27. Therefore thou shalt say unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, drink ye and be drunken. That's to the Babylonians now. And spew and fall and rise no more because of the sword which I will send among you. And it shall be, if they refuse to take the cup at thine hand to drink, then thou shalt say unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, ye shall certainly drink. Well, they were passing around the bottle. They wanted everybody to take a drink. And when it comes their time, the right hand of God will put the bottle to their mouth and force them to drink. It'll not be wine, though it'll be the wrath of God, something far worse than wine that could be poured out of a bottle in that day. This is according to the judgment of God, the rule of judgments that's laid down. Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount said, Matthew 7 and 2, for with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged. That's the law of divine retribution. And with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. The king of Babylon reaped what he sowed. He passed the bottle around, but it came his time to drink, and he had to drink the very dregs of the cup, as it were, when his time came around. And so God is going to judge Babylon of the end time, going to make that Babylonian system drink the cup of his wrath. In Revelation 16, in verse 19, listen to this statement. And the great city was divided into three parts. And the cities of the nations fell, and great Babylon came in remembrance before God to give unto her the cup of the wine of the fierceness of his wrath. So there's a cup of wrath for the Babylon of the end time to drink, as well as a cup of wrath for the invaders in the days of Habakkuk at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. So the systems are alike, and they suffered the same consequence. I thought that was very significant. Somebody said, well, now I want to know what he meant there when he said, let thy foreskin be uncovered. That would prove to the Israelites that the Babylonians were uncircumcised Gentiles. It was a mark of shame. Prove that they were uncircumcised. That's why that it reads like that. And so it seemed like that the Babylonians tried to hide and veil a lot of this evil that they did. But God would bring it to light. I say that it's very much like that today. Men do deeds of darkness and they try to hide them under fair words. But God will uncover that foulness in his own good time. So what's hid today may be totally revealed tomorrow. What's covered up from this generation may be known by the next. The providence of God is most remarkable. It has a way of doing unto others as others have done unto others. That's the way God operates. And then as we go on to the 17th verse, we see how that violence will return upon the head of the violent men. For the violence of Lebanon shall cover thee, and the spoil of beasts, which made them afraid because of man's blood, and for the violence of the land, of the city, and of all that dwell therein. That's quite a devastation if you look at it. They killed the beast, that were upon Mount Lebanon. They killed men. They shed the blood of men. They devastated the land. They destroyed the city. And they killed all kinds of life, human and animal. That's included there, and of all that dwell therein. I've never seen Mount Lebanon. I would like to. It is north. Well, I guess you'd say a little northwest of Palestine. It's really a range of mountains. It's not just one particular mountain so much. It's really a whole range of mountains. Those that have gone and seen it tell me that it's very beautiful to behold. And you can tell from the poetic language in the Psalms and the book of Deuteronomy and other places that it must have been one of the outstanding things for one to see there in the land of Palestine. It was also known for its fruitful vineyards, its abundance of wild game, and most of all for the majestic cedars that were cut down and put in the temple in the days of King Solomon. And so it was a great place, but no doubt these Babylonians cut down the cedars, they killed the beast, they destroyed the vineyards up and down the hillsides, they devastated the whole land. They didn't leave anything. They destroyed the temple where too was the cedars of Lebanon. So they destroyed the mountains as far as its beauty and its natural wildlife supply. They destroyed the temple that had the cedars of Lebanon in it. And so the idea is there's been complete devastation of the mountain, of the people in and around. There's been the city of Jerusalem's been destroyed. The whole land's been made vain and void, you'd see, by these Babylonians. I don't want to sound like an environmentalist here, but I am going to say something. And it's not always clear in the Bible, but I believe it's clear right here. God will punish men for crimes against nature. And I don't mean by that something unnatural, but I'm talking about wildlife. That's right. Violence to the land is the destruction of the natural resources of Israel. And the way it reads there, for the violence against this spoiling of the beast and all of that, and the others that dwell in that land, God was going to send violence on them. Now why? Who do you think owns those animals anyway? So, well, I believe the Game and Fish Commission. No, you're wrong on that. Probably they do as far as the law of the land's concerned. I wouldn't dispute that. At least they're in control of it in most of our states. But I'll tell you who the owner of the animals is. Listen to Psalms 24 and 1. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world, and they that dwell therein. That's everything that dwells therein. So really a crime against nature is a crime against God. Because God owns those animals. He cares for them. He feeds them, and if you unnecessarily destroy them without just cause, there will surely be a dealing with you so far as the law of the land's concerned. But there's a higher law that will personally see that you're prosecuted for it, and that's God. So, well, I thought they were put here for man's food. They are, but they're not just to be killed wastefully, I don't think. There's one rule that I always had. I used to do a lot of hunting when I was growing up. I seldom go now. I never killed anything unless I was going to eat it. I never caught any fish unless I was going to eat them or give them to somebody else. I never wasted anything that I killed. That was the law of the rural Mississippi hills, I guess, when I was growing up. But it was not only me that practiced that law, but it was practiced by everybody else. Because we looked upon wildlife as something belonging to God, and that it was to be used for the good of man and not to be abused without any just cause. I still think that's a pretty good rule to follow. I haven't found anything wrong with it, though it's been 30-some-odd years since I did much hunting or fishing, but I still believe that's a good rule to follow. In the light of the Scripture, I'm certain of it, because violence against animals will be dealt with by God. That's what that says. Now beginning at the 18th verse, going down through the 20th verse, there's a woe to the idolater, and God will leave him without any help. In other words, his idol's not going to be able to help him when the judgment of God falls. If you want to see the evil of idolatry, you'll see that in the next few moments here. Beginning in the 18th verse, he tells us that there's no profit in idolatry. What profiteth the graven image that the maker thereof hath graven it? Wasted a lot of time and maybe money. That's about all. The molten image and a teacher of lies that the maker of his works trusteth therein to make dumb idols. Well, that's what they are, dumb idols. There is no woe in this verse yet. Verse 18 seems to be preparatory to the woe in verse 19. And you'll notice that the woe comes later in the next verse. And so what he's essentially saying in that 18th verse is that you don't gain anything by idol worship. It doesn't profit. A lot of times when we talk about idolatry, people say, well, we don't live in the dark jungles of Africa. We're not the Inca Indians down upon the mountains of South America, you know, we're not idolaters. Sometimes I really believe in America we have more idolaters than probably anywhere else in the world. They're kind of sophisticated idolaters. And they don't really go and bow down before graven images in the sense that the heathens in the dark jungles do. But here in our country we have all kinds of false gods. There's a god of materialism, and it's gotten a hold of quite a number of people. There's a god of sports. There's a god of sex. There's all kinds of gods, you see. Now, why do I call them gods? Because people live only for that. They worship that. All of their energy is devoted in that direction, you see. And they've made an idol. They've made a god out of it. And in that case, too, it's just another dumb idol. That's all you can say for it. Doesn't have any profit to it. Not going to bring any profit at all. I think about some of the statements in the Bible against idolatry and always how that it was said that it didn't profit. It didn't profit. You remember when Samuel was getting after the Israelites, warning them there in the book of 1 Samuel about not going back to their idol worship? And he made a statement, a very good one, in the 21st verse of the 12th chapter. And he made this statement. Turn ye not aside, for then ye will go after vain things which cannot profit nor deliver, for they're vain. Dumb idols cannot save a man's soul. They cannot cause him to inherit the glory world. They cannot give him any assurance or consolation even in this world. They're just dumb idols. That's all. There's no profit to idolatry. That's why it's such a terrible thing, you see. Then look at some other warnings about idolatry. In Isaiah 44, look at verse 9 and 10. They that make a graven image are all of them vanity, and their delectable things shall not profit. And they are their own witnesses, and they see not, nor know, that they may be ashamed. Who hath formed a god, or molded a graven image, that is profitable for nothing? Then look at the 20th verse. He feedeth on ashes, a deceived heart hath turned him aside, that he cannot deliver his soul, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? So there's no profit, you see, in idolatry. It can't save your soul. It can't do anything for you. Similar statements are found in Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 8, verse 11. Many other places in the Bible. It all shows that there's no profit in the worship of idols. Now, I wonder today when I read this, I noticed a statement there. It said a teacher of lies. Strictly speaking, an idol can't be a teacher. It might be an example of a lesson in idolatry some way. But the more I read it, the more I'm convinced that the reference there is to that heathen priest that told the people what the idol supposedly said. They always had the priest, you know. that had to tell the people what the idol said. That was remarkable. But they're just dumb priests. They're just liars. They don't tell the truth. They are a teacher of lies. Isn't it strange that man that is made in the image of God will make an image in the likeness of himself and worship that image? It's almost hard to believe any mortal man would be so depraved as to do that, but they do. They liken God to the image of a four-footed beast or something, or a man. And they worship that creation of their own hand. A lot of people today are worshiping the creation of their own hands, I'm afraid. Dumb idols, that's what they are. Then look at the 19th verse. He tells us that these idols don't have any speech, and they don't have any breath. They're not alive, they're dead. Woe unto him that saith to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is laid over with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in the midst of it. Isn't it strange how these heathens cry out to their idols? There's a good example of that in the Bible, in the book of 1 Kings, the 18th chapter. You remember when they had the fire test between Elijah, that 850 prophets of Baal and the groves? They carried on all day long, crying to their gods, and nothing happened. Let me show you a little example of it. Look in that 18th chapter, verse 26. Now this is of the priest of Baal. And they took the bullock which was given them, and they dressed it, and called on the name of Baal from morning even until noon, saying, O Baal, hear us. How could a dumb idol hear anybody? But there was no voice, nor any that answered, and they leaped upon the altar which was made. They're getting desperate. And it came to pass at noon that Elijah mocked them and said, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is talking, or he is pursuing, or he is in a journey, or peradventure he sleepeth and must be awakened. Well, the dumb idol wasn't doing any of that and couldn't. He knew that. And they cried aloud and cut themselves after their manner with knives and latchets till the blood gushed out upon them. And it came to pass when midday was past, and they prophesied until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice. That'd be about 9 hours, from 6 till 3 in the afternoon, that there was neither voice, nor any to answer, nor any that regarded. After all, what could a dumb idol say anyway? It's a very important lesson there. Sometime when I read that, I wonder if he described a holy roller meeting a little bit, because it sounds a lot like one to me. And I think that's the very same spirit that causes a lot of people to cry out in these charismatic movements today. Same ones that caused them to cry out in the days of Elijah the prophet. But it was not the Holy Spirit. It was demon spirits, you see. And so there's a warning here against idolatry. And we're told what an awful, awful thing that it is to have these idols there and to cry out to them. How could a man who himself makes this idol, in other words, it's his work, the work of his own hands, how could he believe that that thing that's inferior to him is somehow superior to him? Now that mystifies me. I can't conceive how that I could ever look upon something that I make, which I know is inferior to me, somehow being a god or being superior to me. The whole idea is repulsive when you think about it. But you know, that's the way the heathens did. They cried out to their images for help. There are many examples of it in the Bible, not only there in Kings, but elsewhere. In Isaiah 44 and 17, there's another record of how that they cried out to their images to help them. But the images never did help. The dumb idols never did speak. They didn't have any breath. They didn't have any brains. They didn't have anything. Aren't you glad that the God that we worship is not like that? I'm glad that the God we worship is not a dumb idol. What would we have to look forward to if our God was no more than a stick or a stone. Wouldn't be much need to pray. Wouldn't be much need to do anything, come to think about it. If that's all our God was, you see. The psalmist believed he could cry out to God and be heard, because God was a true God. Listen to a cry he made in Psalms 44 and 23. Awake, why sleepest thou, O Lord? Arise, cast us not off forever. He could pray like that because God would hear him, because he was a living God. And then we want to look at the 20th verse, which I believe is one of the greatest verses in this whole book. But the Lord, and the word Lord there is in all capital letters, and our King James Version does that to show that that's Jehovah or Yahweh from the Hebrew, which is the proper name of God in the Bible. That's God's name, Jehovah. That's what we call him in our English language, is Jehovah, but it's Yahweh in the Hebrew, or Yahweh. You can say it two different ways. But the Lord is in his holy temple. You know, that statement's very significant when you think about all that's gone before, all this killing and plundering's going on. It looks like everything is dark and dreary for the nation of Judah. And here is the prophet, in a sense, answering his own questions that he's raised in this book. He said, things are bad on earth, and my country is on the verge of invasion. But said, God's still on his throne. All is well with the world. God is still in his holy temple. He hasn't been moved or changed by political events down here on earth. Isn't that consoling even to know tonight? Amidst all of the devastating disease, amidst all of the fear of nuclear holocaust, and all the evils that we could imagine coming upon our country, upon the human race, it's good to know that the Lord is in his holy temple. He's not disturbed. He's not excited about any of these things that you and I worry about. He's sitting up there, elevated above all of us, above all the universe. And he's sitting there just as calm, cool, and collected as he possibly can. There in Psalms 2, it tells about how that there will be a revolt against God in the last days. During the time of Christ's first advent, said, he that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. He gets kind of tickled at the way we carry on down here sometimes. Somewhat amusing to him. Doesn't get excited, he gets more amused. We're sort of like watching a comedian of some kind. We're so crazy and foolish. God is in his holy temple. Isn't that where he's supposed to be? Didn't he say in Isaiah 57 and 15, I dwell in the high and the holy places? Does the Bible not tell us in Isaiah 66 and verse 1 that heaven is God's throne and the earth is his footstool? God is in heaven. He's there where he should be, sitting on the throne of his holiness. That's his normal residence. That's where the angels are. That's where the departed saints are. They're all there worshiping God. God is in his holy temple. I don't take that too far, because you can't localize God. God is everywhere at the same time. The Bible tells us in 1 Kings 8 and 27 that the heavens of heavens cannot contain him, much less that little temple that Solomon built in his day. God's presence and power is everywhere. But especially it may be said that his presence is more manifest in heaven than anywhere else. Now, God is not in some dumb idol down here on this earth. And God is not in some idol temple. He's not even in some church building. He's not in anything in the absolute sense. God is in heaven. That's his residence. That's the place that he sits upon the throne of his holiness. So Jehovah is not a dumb idol like the heathens worship. Always think of that statement that Moses made in Deuteronomy 32 and verse 31 when he said, their rock is not as our rock. In other words, we serve the living God. They serve dumb idols. There's a difference. In 1 Thessalonians 1 and 9, we read about some people that turn from these dumb idols to serve the living and true God. He is the only one that is God. And all the other gods in the world are nothing more than dumb idols. I don't care who they are. There's only one true and living God, and that living God is elevated up there above all that's unclean and all that's unholy. These Babylonians may march in and they may destroy that temple that has been built in Judea, but they'll never destroy that holy temple of God in heaven where He sits. You can't destroy that temple in heaven where God sits on the throne of His eternal sovereignty. He's always going to be there. And nobody can move Him out of that position. But you know, that's not all this verse said, but the Lord is in His holy temple. Great statement. Let all the earth keep silent before Him. Sometimes I don't think we really understand who God is. I don't believe we have enough respect for Him. We try to be respectful. We try to honor Him. We try to praise Him. But I don't think any of us realize to the absolute degree we ought to, the real worth of God. Just how worthy of worship He is. And you know, the Jews were so reverent of God that they wouldn't even say this word Jehovah a lot of times. They wouldn't even utter the word God. They were too respectful. I wonder sometime if we haven't got very disrespectful in our worship of God on earth. Some churches sound more like they're having a hullabaloo sometime than having a time of worship of God. Really, when you come to the house of God, it ought to be a place where there would be quietness, a place where there would be great respect for God. And if there's anything that is disorderly in the house of God, the earth, the temple, or the heaven, the temple, would be a disrespect for God. That's a terrible thing in my book. So let all the creatures on the earth be still and refrain from all vain talking when in God's presence. And let all of those that worship idols, let them be silent. Let them be convinced of their folly and shame because they do worship idols. Let them stand before God as dumb and as dumbfounded as those idols are that stand before the worshipers on this world. How are we to adore God? By silent respect. You know, sometimes I think one of the most holy times when our church comes together is when we have the Lord's Supper. And if you can just about hear a pin drop, it's during that time we're passing out the bread and the wine to have the Lord's Supper. Really, that's the way it ought to be in the house of God just about all the time. Amen. When we come together to worship. That's why we're told in Psalms 46 and 10, be still and know that I'm God. We're in such a hustle and a bustle today. You can't slow anybody down. You can't get him to think about God. You can't get him to talk about God. He's in too big a rush, you see. That's why the Lord said, be still. He said, stop and listen. He said, I'm God. Take it to mind. Take it to heart. So silent adoring, that's what's commanded here. Let all the earth keep silent before Him. We're told in Psalm 65 and 1 of the Hebrew text that praise is silent before God. I believe our version says waited. But really in the Hebrew it is praise is silent. In other words, you don't run into God's presence shouting and hollering. And I wish a lot of our churches could find that out sometime. God's in His holy temple. Let all the earth be silent. Think about a passage later in the book of Zechariah, just a few pages over here from where we are in the book of Habakkuk in chapter 2 and verse 13. Be silent, O all flesh, before the Lord, for He is raised up out of His holy habitation. How we need a lot of silent adoring of God in our Baptist churches. And we need it in our homes at the table when we pray and when we read and study the Bible. Now that God is in His holy temple is a great thought when you look at all this judgment that's going to come upon these Babylonians as well as upon Judah. There's one thing that God finds intolerable, that's sin. He sits in His holy temple. Not unholy, but a holy temple. And His providence is going to so work in the world that sin will have its own destructive penalties, and God, that is a holy God, will personally see to it that evil does not permanently abide on this earth. So there's the answer to Habakkuk's question. Why don't God do something? He will. He's a holy God. He'll do it when He gets ready. And then we might conclude from all that we've read here in this chapter that sin is moral suicide because of the judgment of God that's coming. There's no escape from it. God won't tolerate it. And whatever you do unto others, God's going to do unto you. So really there's an awful lesson here about how God finds sin so intolerable. He won't endure it. He didn't endure it when it was upon His Son, and He's not going to endure it upon sinners either. Well, let us stand at this time, and we'll have our closing prayer.